Welcome to Season 10 of the Follow My Lead podcast, where each week I bring you stories and best practices of today's leaders to help you on your leadership journey. My name is John Eads. Here we go. Welcome back to another episode of the Follow My Lead podcast, the first episode of Season 10. A new season is with us, and I want to start this episode by simply saying thank you. July was the largest downloaded and listened to month in the history of the show. So I want to say thank you to you, our audience, for continuing to tune in and listen and share with your friends and colleagues. It means a great deal to us that we get to play a small piece in your journey and development as a leader. And this week, this episode just delivers in the biggest way possible because we're joined by one of the real titans and experts in the world of leadership development, Patrick Lencioni, the founder of The Table Group, the author of 12 books, sold over 5 million copies. His most popular book by far was a book in 2002 called The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. And his latest book is called The Ideal Team Player, which came out at the end of last year. He is just one of the most thoughtful and inspiring people we've ever had on. I've looked up to him a long time, and I was so pleased that he was agreed to be with us on the show. You are going to learn a ton from him. We cover what the difference between conflict and accountability is. We talked about why people leave their manager and not companies, and what managers and leaders can do to keep their people fulfilled and happy. We went in depth about teamwork. It's one of these shows that I just didn't want to end. He said something that I think I'll never forget, and that is, he said, people are always willing to settle into the comfort of pain that they know rather than enter into the uncertainty of change that will lead them to a better place. So it's my hope that this episode and this content will help you on your journey. So without further ado, here's my interesting conversation with the one and only Patrick Lencioni. Just a quick word from our sponsors. When change is the only constant, people and businesses must be built to adapt. That Moment is a new podcast from Pivotal about the pivot that changes everything. In each episode of That Moment, business leaders and entrepreneurs share their stories of taking risks and finding success at work and in life. From self-driving cars to new sensor technology, the risk of driving is changing, and in turn, how we insure our drivers. In this week's episode, you will hear about how Allstate is navigating this big shift in their business. And you will also hear from probably the only person who left the New Yorker to become a farmer. Naomi Starkman explains why she left. Find out on the latest episode of That Moment, wherever you listen to podcasts. Well, Pat, thanks for being on the show.
It is great to be with you here today, John.
You know, you've played such a big impact not only on my thinking and journey, but on others. And I want to start by simply saying thank you. What an inspiration that you've been with the five dysfunctions of a team and now ideal team player. When you hear that from people about the impact that you've had on their lives, people you've never met, what does that mean to you?
You know, I'm not going to lie. It's hard to process it sometimes until you kind of go back and you say, okay, thank you, God, for letting me be an instrument. And sometimes I'm aware when I'm being an instrument, sometimes I'm not. And if I tried to make sense of that from an ego standpoint or a personal standpoint and take credit for it, I think I'd go crazy because it would just not be true. I'd be lying to myself to think that I knew what I was doing or that I did it all out of generosity. So I think that the only way for me to actually process that is to thank God for using me and to move forward and not spend a lot of time thinking about it.
Yeah, well, you mentioned God, and I was watching the British Open yesterday, and Jordan Spieth won, and in his post-interview, he was asked about his priorities in life, and he said, my faith is first, my family and my friends are second, and then golf. And I think you've done such an amazing job keeping your faith at the forefront of your priorities. How have you been able to do that, being pulled in so many different directions?
Well, it's by the grace of God. And I was warned when I was young by an executive before I had kids. He admitted to me, he goes, I don't know my 16-year-old son. I've been working for throughout his life, so don't be like that. And so I was very afraid that it would happen to me. But then as I got more and more successful, I found that it was harder and harder to cope with that. And I found that I was going to mass and hearing the parable of the sower. And that, to make a long story short, I felt like I was the seed that landed in the thorns, and I would grow in my faith, but the cares of the world would choke it off. And I just had this very clear understanding that I was never going to be the person I wanted to be until I kind of lost my concern about the worldliness. So fame, money, attention, ego, none of that stuff was satisfying me, and I knew why. And so I kind of went through I hit the wall and decided that I'm not going to be satisfied in life by success. I need to just go to the only thing that's going to last, and that's my faith. And so even though a family I'd never really let go of, I really didn't have it prioritized quite right. And so going back, and I love to hear that Jordan Spieth said that, faith first, even above family and friends, family and friends next, and then my career. And when you get that straight, you find peace. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I think about Jordan Spieth and I think about Tiger Woods, and I just so hope and pray that Tiger Woods finds God, because what a sad thing to be put on that track that he was put on in his life without any context, and to see how unhappy he is now. It's such a testament to the fact that if you don't have those priorities straight, it's going to be sad. It's going to be dark. And Jordan Spieth, hopefully he holds on to that, because that's great.
Yeah, it's really a neat story. And I want to go back just a little bit. I mean, obviously you're most well known for Five Dysfunctions of a Team.
Yes.
I want to know how that came about.
All right. I love to talk about this, because it was somewhat by accident. I will tell you, I got into this field. I was working at a big company, a big software company, and I was just paying attention to these leaders I was working with. The CEO got ousted and a new guy came in. I was also doing some free work with some firms because I was interested in consulting. And I was just observing these various leaders, and I just decided, like I said, hey, there's a pattern to their behavior that's leading to problems. And I came up with this model called the Five Temptations of a CEO. And so I didn't think I was ever going to write a book or start my own company. I was just sharing my insights with people, and they said, you should write a book about this. And I was like, oh, I'm busy. I don't have time to write a book. And they were like, well, somebody's going to write that book. And I thought, okay, now I'm going to write a book, because I don't want somebody else to write this book. So I did it, and then I started my own firm, and we went to Kinko's. We were going to go to Kinko's and just make copies of this little book I wrote, and a publisher found it and said they wanted to publish it. And we were like, oh, that's great. So at least they'll print it for us, and we'll be able to take it to clients. So I wrote my first book, The Five Temptations of a CEO. We shared it with our clients. And then what we realized one day by accident was this leadership model was actually, with a little bit of twists, it was actually a model for teams as well. So it was a few years later that I wrote this book called The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, which was taking this initial leadership model that I wrote and applying it to teams. So it was an accident, and we had no idea what was going to happen. And that book took off like the others. It was my third book, and it just took off and started to sell. And we wrote it for small companies in the Silicon Valley, and we were finding companies all around the world using it, the military, sports teams, big companies, small companies. And it was so beyond anything I intended and so beyond anything I could have imagined. And like I say, you look at that and you go, that's not me. That's a blessing God gave me. And now how do I use this in the way he wants me to? Mm. So it came about through just naked observation, no research, just field research, just working, no like pointed research. And then through watching my clients apply it to leadership and realizing that it actually worked in in teams as well. So I'd like to say I sat down one day and wanted to solve the problem of teamwork, but it really wasn't that intentional.
Well, at the core of it, as I read it multiple times, I just kept coming across this idea of conflict management, and really feeling the conflict that was happening in that story between its people. And then right. I heard you say another time, you said conflict is a disagreement around an issue, and accountability is telling people that they have to do something better.
Right.
Can you expand upon that a little bit? Because this happens every single day in the workplace.
things.
Yes. And so of the five dysfunctions of a team, two of them, I would say, are largely emotional. I mean, they all have some emotion involved. But conflict is when you have to say to somebody, listen, I don't think that idea you have is the right one or it's going to work. That's pretty hard. But, like, I'm pretty good at that. That's okay with me. Accountability is when you actually have to say to somebody, your behavior or your performance is not enough or acceptable, and that is far more personal still. And so what I try to help people understand is, like, disagreeing with somebody around an issue should not be that difficult or that overwhelming, because you're just saying, hey, I see it differently. And I'm good at that naturally, and even as a parent, I don't mind disagreeing with my kids. But when it comes for me to say that behavior is no longer acceptable and you're going to need to change that, it's so easy for even the most driven leader to balk at that. And that's why we have an online team assessment, you know, where teams take 20 minutes to fill out the survey, and then it gives them their results. The lowest score is consistently in accountability. Hmm. Human beings, it's one thing to say to somebody, I don't know if that's a good idea. It's another thing to say, you need to talk less during meetings, or you need to be more respectful when you talk, or you need to prepare more for the meetings we have. Wow, human beings just don't like to do this. And of course, holding people accountable for their behavior is an act of love. I mean, what an act of love to say to somebody, hey, I don't think this behavior is good enough for the team and good enough for you. But human beings don't want to do that. We want to affirm others. We want to be well-liked. And so one of the most sacrificial and difficult things we can do to love a team member or a subordinate is to hold them accountable for their behaviors. And it does not happen enough in the world, John, I tell you.
Well, I think I even heard you say one time, you said something to the effect of, to love one another, it sometimes requires tough love, or love requires toughness, or something to that degree. And I always was struck by the fact that if we're not holding people accountable to those that we can or should be, we are doing them a disservice. And it's certainly relatable in parenting, there's no question.
Absolutely. And it's interesting, because when it gets right down to it, see, I used to not hold people accountable. And I used to joke and say, that's because I'm a wuss. That's a technical term. But the truth of the matter is, I was just selfish. I did not want them to be frustrated with me. And I didn't want them to not like me. So when I would see somebody doing something and say, listen, I don't want to say that to them because they might be frustrated at me, I was actually putting my well-being above theirs. If I love somebody, I love them enough to risk their opinion of me for the sake of their learning, at least in the short term. And so the people I have the strongest relationship with in life are the ones that I've loved enough to humbly and kindly tell them the truth about what I see. And in the end, they appreciate that. Whereas if I haven't done that with a person, I can't really say that I love them. So, but in the moment, I have to actually risk them being mad at me. And that's true as a parent, it's true as a spouse, and it's true as a manager as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, think of accountability and discipline as similar things. And we really define discipline as to promote standards in order for an individual to choose to be at their best. And so much of your work, I feel, really revolves around this idea of choosing correctly. Why is choice so paramount in leadership?
You mean in terms of giving people the choice to opt in?
Exactly.
Well, it's just like, it's free will, you know. If you force somebody to do something, you're not giving them the dignity of making the decision themselves. And it is so important that people opt in, because then they're not going to, one, attribute it to you, but they're going to see that they did it. And two, they're not going to learn. And it is so tempting as a parent to be a dictator, even a loving, benevolent dictator, but that's not allowing them to be the person that they're meant to be. And it's one of those things that in the faith world people talk about too. The idea of free will is really hard for people to understand. And I love when people say, you know, God's a gentleman and he's not going to force you to love him. And you can opt to ignore him. And the same thing is true in work. It's like a person has to have the opportunity to choose to go a different way. Now, there's consequences to that, but those consequences are something that they sign up for.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that if you really want a person to grow, you have to let them opt into something. And that means you are humble enough to let them and your organization suffer a little bit for a greater good. I mean, your model is this one about discipline and love is fascinating. And I think people must look at that and go, oh, wow, I'm a ruler instead of a welder, or or I'm a pleaser instead of a welder. And that's that back and forth that people go through. It's like, am I going to be a ruler or a pleaser? And the answer is do neither.
Well, I know it's so often, you know, and we've worked with hundreds and probably thousands of companies and their leaders. And it's so, I mean, everybody says people leave their manager and not the company. Do you think that's one of the reasons why so many people leave their managers, because they feel like there's no free will? Or what would be some of the reasons why people leave their managers?
Well, you know, I wrote a book once that got at this, because when I was a kid, my dad struggled with his manager in which his company. He was great at what he did, but he'd come home frustrated every night. And I remember thinking, gosh, everybody thinks it's about giving him more money or stock options or benefits and all this other kind of stuff. And people are really missing the core of what people need. And so I came to the conclusion that people need three things. And if they don't get them from their manager, they can't possibly like their job and they're eventually going to leave. And those three things are: one, they need to be known. If they're anonymous, if their manager doesn't know them and take an interest in them as a person and a professional and isn't really interested in their life, you can't love your work. And it's free, but it's like, does your manager know you? That's number one. The second one is, does your manager help you understand why your job matters, why it's relevant? Because irrelevance is the other thing that people can't stand in a job. So the manager's job is to say, do you know why this job you do matters? Do you know how you affect your customers or your coworkers or society or whatever else you're changing? If a manager isn't constantly reminding an employee of that, that employee is not going to love their job. And the third thing that an employee needs from their manager, not from the company, is a way to assess or to understand whether or not they're succeeding. And that cannot be asking your manager for his or her subjective opinion on a given day. Every employee wants to know, I'd like some tangible, observable way to assess for myself whether I'm being successful. So if you're a manager, what you should do is you should say to your people, I want to know all about you and take an interest in you because I care. I want you to know why your job matters, and I want to give you a way to measure how it matters. If you can do those three things, people will never want to stop working for you. And if you're good at that and you go someplace else, they're going to want to come with you. Mm. If you're not doing those things, no matter how famous your company is or how much people think that it's a fun place to work, if you're not getting those things from your managers, and no matter how much money you're making, you are going to go home every day a little bit more discouraged than you did the day before. I've seen this in senior executives of some of the most successful companies. I've seen it among professional athletes. People that you'd think love their work go home miserable because they feel anonymous, irrelevant, and immeasured.
I bet your dad wish you had discovered that when he was still working.
Oh, so many employees, so many readers have said, oh, I wish I'd known this. I've suffered through so many years of work, or I've contributed to that. But it's exactly right. And God bless my dad, who's passed on. But that's one of the reasons I got into this field, because I remember thinking, why does my dad go to work for 9 hours a day and come home frustrated by his management? And now I realize why.
Well, your latest work, The Ideal Team Player, really grasped my attention because sports and just seeing the power of what happens when a team plays well together. For someone that hasn't picked up a new book or read Ideal Team Players, there's kind of three things at its core. You talk about humility, hunger, and people smarts. Can you just go through these three briefly? Just why these three: humility, hunger, and people smarts?
Yeah, and you know something, this is another, most things I've done have been by accident or the grace of God. Which is nice, because I'm looking at this going, I didn't think of this up on my own, and I didn't sit down to try to be smart. Something just kind of occurred to me in the course of my life, and then it turns out to be a lot more valuable than I thought it would ever be. And the same thing happened here is that years ago when I was in a company and I had a small department, we sat down to talk about values. And I thought, what are the things that I really look for in a person so I want to manage them and work with them? And so we came up with Humble, Hungry, and Smart. We had no idea that they had universal values. I thought they were just mine. And then years later, we'd be working with our clients when I started my own consulting firm, and they'd find out what our values are. And they'd say, well, we want those values too. And I said, no, you have to come up with your own. They said, no, we like those. And I thought they were being lazy. And then one day we realized, oh my gosh, if you wanted to be a team player and you didn't have those three characteristics, you really would have to change something or else you weren't going to be a great team player. And so the three values are so simple. And when I wrote this book, John, I thought this book might just be too simple. And yet that's the thing that this book has sold faster earlier in its release than any other book we've ever written, because I think people grasp it and they go, oh my gosh, that's it. You've just put into words what we've been looking for, and that is this. A person has to be humble, which means it's not about themselves, it's about others. They are more into the success of the people around them than in themselves. They're not arrogant, needy, or selfish. It doesn't mean that they're dismissive of their own talents. It means they're just not about themselves. Humble is pretty straightforward. The next one is hungry. They have a desire to work hard, to do more. That when you tell them this is the minimum you need to do, they always go beyond that. And they're looking for greater ways to contribute. They just have that thing in them for some reason to go above and beyond, to say something that sounds like a cliche. And we find that often gets set in a person fairly early in life. You can develop it later, but hungry is one of the things you need. The final one is smart, but not intellectually smart. Smart about people. They have common sense around how to deal with human beings and how their words and actions are going to impact those around them. And a person who's simultaneously humble, hungry, and smart, you can throw them into almost any situation and they're going to add value, make the team better, and contribute to a sense of teamwork. If they're lacking just one of those three things in a significant way, you've got problems. And so that's the description of the model.
Mm. And you touched a little bit on hunger, but can all of those be taught?
I think so, yes. But I have to say I was surprised when I went into it. I kind of thought hunger would be the easiest one to teach because it's so straightforward, mm-hmm. and it's the hardest, I think. Because for whatever reason, it seems like some people are at a place in their lives where they just – aren't naturally motivated to go be above and beyond. Now, so if you've got a person that's not hungry, the way to help them figure this out is to ask them, say, so are you inherently not the kind of person who goes above and beyond? And the answer is probably, they're probably like, no, not really. I don't have that. So then you say, well, what about the mission of what we're trying to do here? Does that motivate you? And maybe you have to better connect them to their purpose, their relevance. And they might say, nah, I'm not really that committed to the mission. And then the last chance you have is to say, okay, but what about your teammates? Even if you're not naturally like that, even if it's not about the mission, what about the fact that you want to be just the best teammate possible and be a hero to those coworkers you have? Some people will find it there. And if they say, nah, actually, I'm okay just being an average player, then what you need to do is you need to say, you know, we can be friends. As my friend Alan Mulally used to say to people at Ford, we could still be friends, but you can't work here. Because if you can't find that passion, that work ethic, either in yourself, in the mission, or in your coworkers, you owe it to yourself and to us to find some place where you can find that. And so that is probably the hardest one to teach. But and like you said, it's probably a function of discipline more than love. I don't think you can love someone to a work ethic. I think maybe, and I'm applying this for the first time, I'm just in real time. I think you can love people into emotional intelligence, into being smart, by loving them enough to constantly remind them. So you realize when you say that, you upset people, right? You don't mean to do that. And they're like, oh, I feel terrible. And if you love them enough to constantly remind them, I think you can help a person become more emotionally intelligent. And I think the same thing happens in humility. Most people that don't demonstrate humility are broken and insecure. Mm-hmm. And if you can love them enough to accept them but to never let them off the hook for when they act that way, I think they can learn how to be humble. So I think discipline is required for if a person's going to be hungry. I think love is what's required for for humility and smart.
Well, I know it sounds like a little bit of an obvious question based on everything that you just said, but I think it's worth asking you just because of your experience. And that is, what does a leader sacrifice, Pat, by not having great teamwork? I mean, I think it's somewhat obvious the gains that a leader or a team can have when they all really come together as a unit and work selflessly. But what do they sacrifice?
Well, it is a great question. The obvious ones where we tend to go, oh, yeah, well, we know the answer. It's like, we know the answer, but do we ever internalize that? The cost of not having a great team, and there's different levels. To me, the greatest cost, and my team and I were just talking about this before, is just the day-to-day experience of work. The idea of pulling up in the parking lot and seeing the cars of your coworkers and going, oh, this is going to be hard. When you come to work, I think there's nothing more motivating and the opposite being and frustrating than not wanting to be with the people you work with. So that's the greatest cost. But let me make it a little bit more tangible for a manager. And that is the cost of losing your best people first. When you don't have teamwork, the best employees you have will be the ones that start to look for a better environment. And so when people say, well, what does it really matter? I say, well, how would you feel if your two best people left first? Because your worst performers, the non-team players, are not going to leave. It's the ones who actually want more and want to come to work and feel good about it and want their teammates to perform well and want to feel like they're holding each other accountable. And oftentimes that's the cost. That's the downside that will motivate a leader who's reluctant to create issues. It'll be the motivator that lets them get messy. Mm. Then the last one is just it's gonna show up on the bottom line.
Yeah.
And that's gonna be through customer satisfaction. It's gonna be through wasted time and energy. It's bad decision making. Teams outperform non-teams, all other things being equal. For me, it's the day-to-day experience of working with people.
Yeah.
That's the big one.
Well,
the thought of the people leaving though is a pretty big one too.
Yeah, I think there's just really some insightful things. Maybe the hardest question I'm going to ask you, and I'm really interested to see your take on this. Why do so many leaders allow it, or why are they okay with just average or below average teamwork?
You know, like so many other things, it's because they're afraid of the pain. You know, I mean, you know, these simple things like no pain, no gain might be one of the best phrases and cliches there ever was. And you ask people like, why are you in this situation, in your work situation or in a personal relationship with somebody? And why don't you change that? And it's like, because the pain of transition and of going through the change is greater to me than the certainty of what I know. Mm. It's the devil you know versus the devil you don't, as they say, or the devil you know versus the angel you don't. And so people are willing to settle into the comfort of pain that they know rather than enter into the uncertainty of change that will lead to a better place. And for a manager who sees this, they're like, I'm going to have an emotional conversation with somebody. I'm going to have to get uncomfortable. I'm going to have to be vulnerable. I'm going to have to even admit that it might be me who's doing this. And in fact, before we started this call, John, we were just chatting. You told me a situation where you realized, and it motivated you to start this company, that you were in a situation you said, it's my issue, not theirs. The willingness to go there and the pain you feel in that moment, that is necessary and inevitable if you're going to grow. And a lot of people aren't willing to do that. When I get on an airplane and I sit next to some heavy person who's intruding onto my space, the first thing I think of is what a drag I have to sit here and do this. The second thing I think of is this must be miserable for them. And I would think that just never having to sit on a four-hour flight and be embarrassed and uncomfortable in intruding into other people's space would be enough to make me want to exercise and get thin. And I think, why in the world would this person go through this? And it's because the pain of having to get there somehow is greater than the pain of what they're experiencing now.
Well, I think it's so true in all areas of life, not just leadership, which I think is so powerful about it. One of the questions I really wanted to ask you is, one of my favorite quotes comes from B.C. Forbes, and he said, the purpose of a business is to produce happiness, not to pile up money. I want to ask you if you agree with that, number one. And then number two, when you find leaders or you work with companies where people don't agree with that, what do you do?
Okay, so the first thing is I think I agree that the word happiness is a difficult one. I do believe it at the highest level, every great business, every great organization or company exists to somehow make the lives of others better. And I think that's what he means by happiness.
Right.
You ultimately, if you're not improving someone else's life in some way, large or small, then it's not a business. I mean, that's why you exist. Money is a determinant that in a capitalist society or in a free market that you're doing it well. And which is good to measure, because it just means, hey, there's something there. But ultimately it has to be adding to someone else's life in some way, hopefully in a good way. And so the second part of your question is, what do you do when people disagree with that? Well, sometimes it's just a matter of helping them understand that they think, well, if I'm not adding to my bottom line, then what they're really confusing the purpose versus the measurement. Mm-hmm. But sometimes people don't get that because they're so broken that they feel like what the purpose of a business is to manipulate the world so that they can win and others can lose. And that is just a recipe for dark, dark future. Because that person who does that for a short period of time, and there's some entrepreneurs who can do that, at the end of the day, they're left staring at the wall thinking, why did this matter? Because at the end of the day, the people who run Southwest Airlines or Chick-fil-A, who are two of my favorite clients to talk about, do not say, well, look what happened to my bank account. They say, look at the employees that work here and how their lives have changed, and look at these customers who we've served, and look at how their lives have changed, and look at how we're giving people opportunities that they didn't have, because the money just doesn't suffice. Money is a satisfier. You need enough of it to get through in life, but love and service and selflessness is a driver. You can never get enough of that. So a person who thinks that it's all about money is either thinking about it in the wrong definition, or they're so broken that they don't understand that there's something greater out there. Mm.
Well, let's end on some fun stuff. My two favorite questions. The first is, what's harder, leading at work or leading at home?
Oh, leading at home. And it's because it's more important, for one, and so it's so painful when we don't do it well. The reason why it's harder at home is because of this problem called unconditional love, which is wonderful, but generally our children and our wives or husbands are not going to fire us. And that's a wonderful thing, because that's unconditional love. The problem is when we don't see that as a blessing but as a permission, and so we don't pour in enough to our leadership as a parent or a spouse, because we think, well, they're going to understand. Whereas at work, we think they might actually quit because they're not going to do that. And so we go home and we tolerate ambiguity and reactiveness and lack of a plan and lack of meetings, if you will, and discussion, because we think, well, what are the ramifications of that? And the ramifications are much deeper and long term. Whereas we go to work and we know that our revenue will go down and our customers might leave and an employee might quit, so we think we have to do this. So it's harder to do at home because we don't have the near-term incentives, and we can get away from being kind of a jerk to our spouse or to our kids. And so that's why it's harder. I also think, boy, it's harder at home because it's just so much more important and we're afraid. Mm-hmm. I think it's just I just care so much more about what happens to my kids than I do my clients. And I care a lot about my clients, but I think sometimes I can be so worried about my kids that I can actually get paralyzed.
And you have four boys?
Four boys. Boy. And I love my wife, and that's the other thing about
home. She's at a big time disadvantage.
Oh my gosh. And she grew up with all girls. And so she had no idea what she was in for. Neither did I. But we love it.
Well, that's
so
awesome.
I think it's easier to do at work. The other thing is, you know, I've written 12 books, I think, and 11 of them have been about business. One has been about family. And the the small group of people that have read my family book will tell you it's the best one and it's changed their lives the most. But so few people actually go do research about how to run their family. And so for whatever reason, we spend time learning and going to classes and seminars and training courses about how to run our business. And then at home, we wing it. And so that's what makes it harder, too. We don't look at it as something that we should actually be experts in. We think that because God gave us the natural ability to have a child, that somehow we are qualified to properly raise a child. So probably because we underprepare, it's why it's harder, too.
It's the best answer we've ever heard. So, and we've asked 80 leaders, and I think the majority is at home. Most of them say at home, but I don't know that anybody's been as thoughtful about the answer as you, and it doesn't surprise me. You get to have dinner with any three leaders, living or dead. Who are those three leaders?
Okay, so we will take Jesus off the list because he's my God, and so he's not just a leader. So but he's number one, of course.
Well, he's got to be on the list then.
Okay, yeah, well, he's number one, two, and three. So he's number one. Let's say you said, okay, you have to have a two and a three. You know, I would probably say, and there's a few other people like them, probably Maximilian Kolbe. And he's the saint that was in, I think it was Dachau, and was in the concentration camp, and they were going to kill one of the prisoners because somebody tried to escape. And he said, I will die for him. He has a family. Take me. And they let him go, and then they starved him to death. And while they were starving him to death, he was praying for them. And it's like to think about actually doing that. And this guy did this like 65, 70 years ago, or about 80 years ago now. Think about that. That's like a man actually stood up and said, I will die for a stranger. And I will let you torture me as I do that, and I'll pray for you. So I'd want to just talk to him and understand how he is in that. And the other answer would be living or dead. You know, I'm thinking back in time. I'm probably St. Thomas More, who was like the king of England's right-hand man and a very famous, well-respected guy, and he wouldn't cave on his principles. And the king, even though his own family and many of the other people around him were begging him to just give in and just tell the king he was right about something, he said, I have to stick true to my principles, and he went to his death for that, because at great cost. And again, I would just like to know, what's that like to have such principle and such love of truth that you're willing to give the ultimate sacrifice? So Jesus, Maximilian Kolbe, and Thomas More.
Well,
that's off the top of my head, those are the three.
Well, that's a great list, and we are 100% smarter for you coming on. Where can people find out more about you and the business, and where can we send people?
Well, there's two places. I mean, the place to go is tablegroup.com. So that's www, of course, table like kitchen table, tablegroup.com. And that's our website. But we also have this thing, tablegroup.com/hub, is where we put out weekly new information, small articles, longer articles about leadership and about how to be organizational healthy. So that's a place. The other thing is there's this organization I helped start called theamazingparish.com, amazingparish.org. And that's this other thing I'm doing, and you can find out what we're doing in the church world as well.
Well, Pat, thank you so much for doing it. You're a great example to so many, and we're grateful that you spent a few minutes with us today, so thanks.
I'm grateful to be here, John, and it's great to have met a new friend.
I hope you enjoyed another episode of the Follow My Lead podcast. It would mean a great deal to us if you'd share this episode on social media or with any of your friends that you think might benefit from listening to the show. We hope that we keep adding value to your life. So until next time, be a good leader at work and at home.